Chapter 7. The Inadequacy of Grammar. Gone is the whiteness of snow. Green returns in the grass of the fields, in the canopies of trees, and the airy grace of spring is with us again. Thus time revolves. The passing hour that steals the light brings a message. Immortality, for us, is impossible. Warm winds will be followed by cold. Book 4, Ode 7. Usually we call real the things that exist now, in the present, not those which existed once or may do so in the future. We say that things in the past or the future were real or will be real, but we do not say they are real. Philosophers call presentism the idea that only the present is real, that the past and the future are not, and that reality evolves from one present to another successive one. This way of thinking no longer works, however, if the present is not defined globally, if it is defined only in our vicinity in an approximate way. If the present that is far away from here is not defined, what is real in the universe? All the diagrams and illustrations we have imagined in previous chapters depict an entire evolution of space-time with a single image. They do not represent a single time, but all times together. They are like a sequence of photographs of a man running, or a book containing a story that develops over many years. They are a schematic representation of a possible history of the world, not of one of its single instantaneous states. But in a better representation of the temporal structure of the world, there is nothing that resembles a present. There is no present. So, what is real now? 20th century physics shows, in a way that seems unequivocal to me, that our world is not described well by presentism. An objective, global present does not exist. The most we can speak of is a present relative to a moving observer. But then what is real for me is different from that which is real for you, despite the fact that we would like to use the expression real in an objective sense as much as possible. Therefore, the world should not be thought of as a succession of presents. What alternatives do we have? Philosophers call eternalism the idea that flow and change are illusory. Present, past, and future are all equally real and equally existent. Eternalism is the idea that the whole of space-time exists altogether in its entirety without anything changing. Nothing really flows. Those who defend this way of thinking about reality, eternalism, frequently cite Einstein, who, in a famous letter, writes, "People like us who believe in physics know that the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion." This idea has come to be called the block universe. The idea that it is necessary to think of the history of the universe as a single block, all equally real, and that the passage from one moment of time to the next is illusory. And so is this eternalism, the block universe, the only way left for us to conceive of the world? Must we think of the world with past, present, and future like a single present, all existing in the same way? That nothing changes, and that everything is motionless? Is change only an illusion? No, I really don't think so. The fact that we cannot arrange the universe like a single orderly sequence of times does not mean that nothing changes. It means that changes are not arranged in a single orderly succession. The temporal structure of the world is more complex than a simple, single, linear succession of instants. This does not mean that it is non-existent or illusory. The distinction between past, present, and future is not an illusion. It is the temporal structure of the world. But the temporal structure of the world is not that of presentism. The temporal relations between events are more complex than we previously thought. but they do not cease to exist on account of this. The relations of filiation do not establish a global order, but this does not make them illusory. If we are not all in single file, it does not follow that there are no relations between us. Change. What happens? This is not an illusion. What we have discovered is that it does not follow a global order. Let's return to the question with which we began. What is real? What exists? The answer is that this is a badly put question signifying everything and nothing. Because the adjective real is ambiguous. It has 1,000 meanings. The verb to exist has even more. To the question, does a puppet whose nose grows when he lies exist? It is possible to reply, of course he exists, it's Pinocchio. Or, no, he doesn't, he's only part of a fantasy dreamed up by Collodi. Both answers are correct because they are using different meanings of the verb to exist. There are so many different usages of the verb, different ways in which we can say that a thing exists, a law, a stone, a nation, a war, a character in a play, the god or gods of a religion to which we do not belong, the god of the religion to which we do belong, a great love, a number. Each one of these entities exists and is real in a sense different from all the others. We can ask ourselves in what sense something exists or not. Pinocchio exists as a literary character, but not as far as any Italian register office is concerned. Or if a thing exists in a determined way, does a rule exist preventing you from castling in chess if you have already moved the castle? To ask oneself in general what exists or what is real means only to ask how you would like to use a verb and an adjective. It's a grammatical question, not a question about nature. Nature, for its part, is what it is, and we discover it very gradually. If our grammar and our intuition do not readily adapt to what we discover, well, too bad. We must seek to adapt them. The grammar of many modern languages conjugates verbs in the present, past, and future tenses. It is not well adapted for speaking about the real temporal structure of reality, which is more complex. Grammar developed from our limited experience before we became aware of its imprecision when it came to grasping the rich structure of the world. What confuses us when we seek to make sense of the discovery that no objective universal present exists is only the fact that our grammar is organized around an absolute distinction. Past, present, future. That is only partially apt here in our immediate vicinity. The structure of reality is not the one that this grammar presupposes. We say that an event is, or has been, or will be. We do not have grammar adapted to say that an event has been in relation to me, but is in relation to you. We must not allow ourselves to be confused by an inadequate grammar. There is a text from the world of antiquity which refers to the spherical shape of the earth in the following way. For those standing below, things above are below, while things below are above, and this is the case around the entire earth. On first reading, the phrase is a muddle, a contradiction in terms. How is it possible that things above are below while things below are above? It makes no sense. It is comparable to the sinister fair is foul and foul is fair in Macbeth. But if we reread it, bearing in mind the shape and the physics of the earth, the phrase becomes clear. Its author is saying that for those who live at the Antipodes in Australia, the direction upwards is the same as downwards for those who are in Europe. He is saying, that is, that the direction above changes from one place to another on the earth. He means that what is above with respect to Sydney is below with respect to us. The author of this text, written 2,000 years ago, is struggling to adapt his language and his intuition to a new discovery, the fact that the Earth is a sphere, and that up and down have a meaning that changes between here and there. The terms do not have, as previously thought, a single and universal meaning. We are in the same situation. We are struggling to adapt our language and our intuition to a new discovery, the fact that past and future do not have a universal meaning. Instead, they have a meaning which changes between here and there. That's all there is to it. In the world, there is change. There is a temporal structure of relations between events that is anything but illusory. It is not a global happening. It is a local and complex one, which is not amenable to being described in terms of a single global order. And what about Einstein's phrase, the distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion? Does it not seem to say that he thought the opposite? Even if this were the case, I'm not sure that because Einstein has penned some phrase or other, we should treat it as the utterance of an oracle. Einstein changed his mind many times on fundamental questions, and it is possible to find numerous erroneous phrases of his that contradict each other. But in this instance, things are perhaps much simpler or more profound. Einstein coins this phrase when his friend Michele Besso dies. Michele has been his dearest friend, the companion of his thinking and discussion since his days at the University of Zurich. The letter in which Einstein writes the phrase is not directed at physicists or philosophers. It is addressed to Michele's family, in particular his sister. The sentence that comes before it reads, "Now he, Michele, has departed from this strange world a little ahead of me." That means nothing. It is not a letter written to pontificate about the structure of the world. It is a letter written to console a grieving sister. A gentle letter, alluding to the spiritual bond between Michele and Albert. A letter in which Einstein also confronts his own suffering at the loss of his lifelong friend, and in which, evidently, he is thinking about his own approaching death. A deeply emotional letter, in which the illusoriness and the heart-rending irrelevance to which he alludes do not refer to time as understood by physicists. They are prompted by the experience of life itself, fragile, brief, full of illusions. It's a phrase that speaks of things that lie deeper than the physical nature of time. Einstein died on April the 18th, 1955, 1 month and 3 days after the death of his friend. Chapter 8. Dynamics as relation. Sooner or later, the exact measurement of our time will resume, and we'll be on the ship that's bound for the bitterest shore. Book 2, Ode 9. How does one describe a world in which everything occurs, but there is no time variable, in which there is no common time, and no privileged direction in which change occurs? In the simplest way, the same way that we had thought about the world until Newton convinced us all that a variable time was indispensable. To describe the world, the time variable is not required. What is required are variables that actually describe it, quantities that we can perceive, observe, and eventually measure. The length of a road, the height of a tree, the temperature of a forehead, the weight of a piece of bread, the color of the sky, the number of stars in the celestial vault, the elasticity of a piece of bamboo, the speed of a train, the pressure of a hand on a shoulder, the pain of a loss, the position of the hands on a clock, the height of the sun in the sky. These are the terms in which we describe the world. Quantities and properties that we see continuously changing. In these changes, there are regularities. A stone falls faster than a feather. Sun and moon circle after each other in the sky, passing by each other once a month. Among these quantities, there are some that we see changing regularly with respect to others. The number of days, the phases of the moon, the height of the sun on the horizon, the position of the hands of a clock. It is useful to employ these as points of reference. Let's meet 3 days after the next full moon when the sun is at its highest in the sky. I'll see you tomorrow when the clock shows 4:35. If we find a sufficient number of variables that remain synchronized enough in relation to each other, it is convenient to use them in order to speak of when. There is no need in any of this to choose a privileged variable and call it time. What we need, if we want to do science, is a theory that tells us how the variables change with respect to each other. That is to say, how one changes when others change. The fundamental theory of the world must be constructed in this way. It does not need a time variable. It needs to tell us only how things that we see in the world vary with respect to each other. That is to say, what the relations may be between these variables. The fundamental equations of quantum gravity are effectively formulated like this. They do not have a time variable, and they describe the world by indicating the possible relations between variable quantities. In 1967, an equation accounting for quantum gravity was written for the first time without any time variable. This equation was discovered by two American physicists, Bryce DeWitt and John Wheeler, and today it's known as the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. At first, no one could understand the significance of an equation without a time variable, perhaps not even Wheeler and DeWitt themselves. Wheeler, explain time, not without explaining existence? Explain existence, not without explaining time? To uncover the deep and hidden connection between time and existence is a task for the future. The issue was discussed at great length. There were conferences, debates, rivers of ink flowed. I think that the dust has now settled and things have become much clearer. There is nothing mysterious about the absence of time in the fundamental equation of quantum gravity. It is only the consequence of the fact that, at the fundamental level, no special variable exists. The theory does not describe how things evolve in time. The theory describes how things change, one in respect to the others. How things happen in the world in relation to each other. That's all there is to it. Bryce and John left us some years ago. I knew them both and had great admiration and respect for them. In my study at the University of Marseille, I have hanging on my wall the letter that John Wheeler wrote to me when he became aware of my first work on quantum gravity. Every so often I reread it with a mixture of pride and nostalgia. I would have liked to have asked him more during the handful of meetings that we had together. The last time I went to see him in Princeton, we took a long walk together. He spoke to me with the soft voice of an old man. I could not make out much of what he said, but did not dare to ask him too frequently to repeat what he was saying. Now he is no longer with us. I can't question him anymore. Or tell him what I think. I can no longer tell him that it seems to me that his ideas are correct, and that they have guided me throughout a lifetime of research. I can no longer tell him that I believe that he was the first to come close to the heart of the mystery of quantum gravity. Because he is no longer here, here and now. This is time for us. Memory and nostalgia. The pain of absence. But it isn't absence that causes sorrow. It is affection and love. Without affection, without love, such absences would cause us no pain. For this reason, even the pain caused by absence is in the end something good and even beautiful. Because it feeds on that which gives meaning to life. I met Bryce in London on the first occasion that I went to seek out a group working on quantum gravity. I was a young novice fascinated by this arcane subject that no one in Italy was working on. He was its grand guru. I had gone to Imperial College to meet up with Chris Isham, and when I arrived I was told that he was on the top floor terrace. Sitting together at a small table up there, I found Chris Isham, Carol Kucher, and Bryce DeWitt. The three main authors whose ideas I had been studying in recent years. I remember vividly the intense impression that I had on seeing them there, through the glass, calmly discussing among themselves. I did not dare to interrupt. They seemed to me like three great Zen masters exchanging unfathomable truths between enigmatic smiles. They were probably only deciding where to go for dinner. Revisiting and reflecting on the episode, I realized that at the time they were younger than I am now. This too is time. A strange shifting of perspective. Shortly before he died, Bryce gave a long interview in Italy, subsequently published in a small book. And it was only then I became aware that he'd followed my work much more closely, and with more sympathy than I had ever suspected from our conversations, in which he was more prone to express criticism than encouragement. John and Bryce were my spiritual fathers. Thirsting, I found in their ideas fresh, clear water to drink. So thank you, John. Thanks, Bryce. As human beings, we live by emotions and thoughts. We exchange them when we are in the same place at the same time, talking to each other, looking into each other's eyes, brushing against each other's skin. We are nourished by this network of encounters and exchanges. But in reality, we do not need to be in the same place and time to have such exchanges. Thoughts and emotions that create bonds of attachment between us have no difficulty in crossing seas and decades, sometimes even centuries, tied to thin sheets of paper or dancing between the microchips of a computer. We are part of a network that goes far beyond the few days of our lives and the few square meters that we tread. This book is also a part of that weave. But I have digressed and lost my thread. Nostalgia for John and Bryce has caused me to deviate from my path. All I had intended to say in this chapter is that they had discovered the extremely simple structure of the equation that describes the dynamics of the world. It describes possible events and the correlations between them, and nothing else. It's the elementary form of the mechanics of the world, and it does not need to mention time. The world without a time variable is not a complicated one. It is a net of interconnected events, where the variables in play adhere to probabilistic rules, which, incredibly, we know for a good part how to write. And it is a clear world, windswept and full of beauty as the crests of mountains, as beautiful as the cracked lips of adolescence. Elementary quantum events and spin networks. The equations of loop quantum gravity on which I work are a modern version of the theory of Wheeler and DeWitt. There is no time variable in these equations. The variables of the theory describe the fields that form matter, photons, electrons, other components of atoms, and the gravitational field, all on the same level. Loop theory is not a unified theory of everything. It doesn't even begin to claim that it's the ultimate theory of science. It's a theory made up of coherent but distinct parts. It seeks to be only a coherent description of the world as we understand it so far. The fields manifest themselves in granular form. Elementary particles, photons, and quanta of gravity, or rather, quanta of space. These elementary grains do not exist immersed in space. Rather, they themselves form that space. The spatiality of the world consists of the web of their interactions. They do not dwell in time. They interact incessantly with each other and indeed exist only in terms of these incessant interactions. And this interaction is the happening of the world. It is the minimum elementary form of time that is neither directional nor linear. Nor does it have the curved and smooth geometry studied by Einstein. It is a reciprocal interaction in which quanta manifest themselves in the interaction in relation to that with which they interact. The dynamic of these interactions is probabilistic. The probabilities that something will happen, given the occurrence of something else, can in principle be calculated with the equations of the theory. We cannot draw a complete map, a complete geometry of everything that happens in the world, because Such happenings, including the passage of time, are always triggered only by an interaction with and with respect to a physical system involved in the interaction. The world is like a collection of interrelated points of view. To speak of the world seen from outside makes no sense, because there is no outside to the world. The elementary quanta of the gravitational field exist at Planck scale. They are the elementary grains that weave the mobile fabric with which Einstein reinterpreted Newton's absolute space and time. It is these and their interactions which determine the extension of space and the duration of time. The relations of spatial adjacency tie the grains of space into webs. We call these spin networks. The name spin comes from the mathematics which describe the grains of space. A ring in the spin network is called a loop, and these are the loops that give loop theory its name. The webs in turn transform into each other in discrete leaps described in the theory as structures called spin foam. The occurrence of these leaps draws the patterns that on a large scale appear to us like the smooth structure of space-time. On a small scale, the theory describes a quantum space-time that is fluctuating, probabilistic, and discrete. At this scale, there is only the frenzied swarming of quanta that appear and vanish. This is the world with which I seek daily to come to terms. An unusual world, but not a meaningless one. In my research group in Marseille, for example, we are attempting to calculate the time needed for a black hole to explode when it passes through a quantum phase. During the course of this phase, inside the black hole and within its immediate vicinity, there is no longer a single and determinate space-time. There is a quantum superposition of spin webs. Just as an electron can unfurl into a cloud of probabilities between the moment it is emitted and the moment it arrives on a screen, passing through more than one place, so the space-time of the quantum collapse of a black hole passes through a phase in which time fluctuates violently. There is a quantum superposition of different times, and then, later, a return to a determined state after the explosion. For this intermediate phase, where time is wholly indeterminate, we still have equations that tell us what happens. Equations without time. This is the world described by loop theory. Am I certain that this is the correct description of the world? I am not. But it is today the only coherent and complete way that I know of to think about the structure of space-time without neglecting its quantum properties. Loop quantum gravity shows that it is possible to write a coherent theory without fundamental space and time, and that it can be used to make qualitative predictions. In a theory of this kind, time and space are no longer containers or general forms of the world. They are approximations of a quantum dynamic that in itself knows neither space nor time. There are only events and relations. It is the world without time of elementary physics. Part 3. The Sources of Time. Chapter 9. Time is Ignorance. Do not ask about the outcome of my days, or of yours, Lucanoe. It's a secret beyond us. And don't attempt abstruse calculations. Book 1, Ode 11. There is a time to be born, and a time to die, a time to weep, and a time to dance, a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to destroy and a time to build. Up to this point, it has been a time to destroy time. Now, it is time to rebuild the time that we experience, to look for its sources, to understand where it comes from. If in the elementary dynamic of the world all the variables are equivalent, what is this thing that we humans call time? What is it that my watch measures? What is it that always runs forwards and never backwards, and why? It may not be part of the elementary grammar of the world, but what is it? There are so many things that are not part of the elementary grammar of the world and that simply emerge in some way. For example, a cat is not part of the elementary ingredients of the universe. It is something complex that emerges and repeats itself in various parts of our planet. A group of boys on a field decide to have a match. They form teams. This is how we used to do it. The two most enterprising would take turns choosing the players they wanted, having tossed a coin to see who would have first pick. At the end of this solemn procedure, there were two teams. Where were the teams before they were chosen? Nowhere. They emerged from the procedure. Where do high and low come from? Terms that are so familiar and yet are not in the elementary equations of the world. From the earth that is so close to us and that attracts, high and low emerge in certain circumstances in the universe, as when there is a large mass nearby. In the mountains, we see a valley covered by a sea of white clouds. The surface of the clouds gleams immaculate. We start to walk towards the valley. The air becomes more humid, then less clear. The sky is no longer blue. We find ourselves in a fog. Where did the well-defined surface of the clouds go? It vanished. Its disappearance is gradual. There is no surface that separates the fog from the sparse air of the heights. Was it an illusion? No, it was a view from afar. Come to think of it, it's like this with all surfaces. This dense marble table would look like a fog if I were shrunk to a small enough atomic scale. Everything in the world becomes blurred when seen close up. Where exactly does the mountain end? And where do the plains begin? Where does the savannah begin and the desert end? We cut the world into large slices. We think of it in terms of concepts that are meaningful for us, that emerge at a certain scale. We see the sky turning around us every day, but we are the ones who are turning. Is the daily spectacle of a revolving universe illusory? No, it is real. But it doesn't involve the cosmos alone. It involves our relation with the sun and the stars. We understand it by asking ourselves how we move. Cosmic movement emerges from the relation between the cosmos and ourselves. In these examples, something that is real, a cat, a football team, high and low, the surface of clouds, the rotation of the cosmos, emerges from a world that at a much simpler level has no cats, teams, up or down, no surface of clouds, no revolving cosmos. Time emerges from a world without time, in a way that has something in common with each of these examples. The reconstruction of time begins here in two little chapters, this one and the next, that are brief and technical. If you find them heavy going, skip them and go directly to chapter 11. From there, step by step, we will gradually reach more human things. Thermal time. In the frenzy of thermal molecular mingling, all the variables that can possibly vary do so continuously. One, however, does not vary: the total amount of energy in any isolated system. Between energy and time, there is a close bond. They form one of those characteristic couples of quantities that physicists call conjugate, such as position and momentum, or orientation and angular momentum. The two terms of these couples are tied to each other. On the one hand, knowing what the energy of a system may be, how it is linked to the other variables, is the same as knowing how time flows, because the equations of evolution in time follow from the form of its energy. On the other, energy is conserved in time, hence it cannot vary, even when everything else varies. In its thermal agitation, a system passes through all the configurations that have the same energy, but only these. The set of these configurations, which our blurred macroscopic vision does not distinguish, is the macroscopic state of equilibrium. a placid glass of hot water. The usual way of interpreting the relation between time and the state of equilibrium is to think that time is something absolute and objective. Energy governs the time evolution of a system, and the system in equilibrium mixes all configurations of equal energy. The conventional logic for interpreting this relation is therefore that to define the macroscopic state, we first need to know the energy. And to define energy, we first need to know what is time. In this logic, time comes first and is independent from the rest. But there is another way of thinking about this same relationship, by reading it in reverse. That is, to observe that a macroscopic state, which is to say a blurred vision of the world, may be interpreted as a mingling that preserves an energy, and this in its turn generates a time. This observation opens up a new perspective. In an elementary physical system, without any privileged variable that acts like time, where in effect, all the variables are on the same level, but we can have only a blurred vision of them described by macroscopic states. A generic macroscopic state determines a time. I'll repeat this point because it's a key one. A macroscopic state, which ignores the details, chooses a particular variable that has some of the characteristics of time. In other words, a time becomes determined simply as an effect of blurring. Boltzmann understood that the behavior of heat involves blurring. From the fact that inside a glass of water, there is a myriad of microscopic variables that we do not see. The number of possible microscopic configurations for water is its entropy. But something further is also true. The blurring itself determines a particular variable. Time. In fundamental relativistic physics, where no variable plays a priori the role of time, we can reverse the relation between macroscopic state and evolution of time. It is not the evolution of time that determines the state. It is the state, the blurring, that determines a time. Time that is determined in this way by a macroscopic state is called thermal time. In what sense may it be said to be a time? From a microscopic point of view, there is nothing special about it. It is a variable like any other. But from a macroscopic one, it has a crucial characteristic. Among so many variables, all at the same level, thermal time is the one with behavior that most closely resembles the variable we usually call time, because its relations with the macroscopic states are exactly those that we know from thermodynamics. But it is not a universal time. It is determined by a macroscopic state, that is, by a blurring, by the incompleteness of a description. In the next chapter, I will discuss the origin of this blurring. But before doing so, let's take another step by bringing quantum mechanics into consideration. Quantum time. Roger Penrose is among the most lucid of those scientists who have focused on space and time. He reached the conclusion that the physics of relativity is not incompatible with our experience of the flowing of time, but that it does not seem sufficient to account for it. He has suggested that what's missing might be what happens in a quantum interaction. Alain Kohn, the great French mathematician, has pointed out the deep role of quantum interaction at the root of time. When an interaction renders the position of a molecule concrete, the state of the molecule is altered. The same applies for its speed. If what materializes first is the speed and then the position, the state of the molecule changes in a different way than if the order of the two events were reversed. The order matters. If I measure the position of an electron first and then its speed, its state changes differently than if I were to measure its velocity first and then its position. This is called the non-commutativity of the quantum variables, because position and speed do not commute. That is to say, they cannot exchange order with impunity. This non-commutativity is one of the characteristic phenomena of quantum mechanics. Non-commutativity determines an order and, consequently, a germ of temporality in the determination of two physical variables. To determine a physical variable is not an isolated act. It involves interaction. The effect of such interactions depends on their order. And this order is a primitive form of the temporal order. Perhaps it's the very fact that the effect of these interactions depends on the order in which they take place that is at the root of the temporal order of the world. This is the fascinating idea suggested by Kohn. The first germ of temporality in elementary quantum transitions lies in the fact that these interactions are naturally, partially, ordered. Kohn has provided a refined mathematical version of this idea. He has shown that a kind of temporal flow is implicitly defined by the non-commutativity of the physical variables. Due to this non-commutativity, the set of physical variables in a system defines a mathematical structure called non-commutative von Neumann algebra. And Kohn has shown that these structures have within themselves an implicitly defined flow. Surprisingly, there is an extremely close relation between Alan Kohn's flow for quantum systems and the thermal time that I've discussed above. Kohn has shown that in a quantum system, the thermal flows determined by different macroscopic states are equivalent up to certain internal symmetries, and that together they form precisely the Kohn flow. Put more simply, the time determined by macroscopic states and the time determined by quantum non-commutativity are aspects of the same phenomenon. And it is this thermal and quantum time, I believe, that is the variable that we call time in our real universe, where a time variable does not exist at the fundamental level. The intrinsic quantum indeterminacy of things produces a blurring, like Boltzmann's blurring, which ensures, contrary to what classic physics seemed to indicate, that the unpredictability of the world is maintained, even if it were possible to measure everything that is measurable. Both the sources of blurring, quantum indeterminacy, and the fact that physical systems are composed of zillions of molecules are at the heart of time. Temporality is profoundly linked to blurring. The blurring is due to the fact that we are ignorant of the microscopic details of the world. The time of physics is ultimately the expression of our ignorance of the world. Time is ignorance. Alan Kohn has co-authored with two friends a short science fiction novel. Charlotte, the protagonist, manages to have for a moment a totality of information about the world without blurring. She manages to see the world directly beyond time. I have had the unheard-of good fortune of experiencing a global vision of my being, not of a particular moment, but of my existence as a whole. I was able to compare its finite nature in space, against which no one protests, with its finite nature in time, which is instead the source of so much outrage. And then returning to time, I had the impression of losing all the infinite information generated by the quantum scene, and this loss was sufficient to drag me irresistibly into the river of time. The emotion that results from this is an emotion of time. This re-emergence of time seemed to me like an intrusion, a source of mental confusion, anguish, fear, and alienation. Our blurred and indeterminate image of reality determines a variable thermal time that turns out to have certain peculiar properties which begin to resemble what we call time. It is in the correct relation with equilibrium states. Thermal time is tied to thermodynamics, and hence to heat, but does not yet resemble time as we experience it because it does not distinguish between the past and the future, has no direction, and lacks what we mean when we speak of its flow. We have not yet reached the time of our own experience. the difference between the past and the future that is so important to us. Where does that come from? Chapter 10. Perspective. In the impenetrable night of his wisdom, a god closes the strip of days that's to come and laughs at our human trepidation. Book 3, Ode 29. The entire difference between past and future may be attributed solely to the fact that the entropy of the world was low in the past. Why was entropy low in the past? In this chapter, I will give an account of an idea that provides a possible answer. If, as Nietzsche says, you will hear my answer to this question, and it's perhaps extravagant supposition. I am not sure that it is the correct answer, but it's the one with which I have become enamored. It might clarify many things. We are the ones turning. Whatever we human beings may be specifically in detail, we are nevertheless pieces of nature, a part of the great fresco of the cosmos, a small part among many others. Between ourselves and the rest of the world, there are physical interactions. Obviously, not all the variables of the world interact with us or with the segment of the world to which we belong. Only a very minute fraction of these variables does so. Most of them do not react with us at all. They do not register us, and we do not register them. This is why distinct configurations of the world seem equivalent to us. The physical interaction between myself and a glass of water, two pieces of the world, is independent of the motion of the single molecules of water. In the same way, the physical interaction between myself and a distant galaxy, two pieces of the world, ignores what happens in detail out there. Therefore, our vision of the world is blurred because the physical interactions between the part of the world to which we belong and the rest are blind to many variables. This blurring is at the heart of Boltzmann's theory. From this blurring, the concepts of heat and entropy are born, and these are linked to the phenomena that characterize the flow of time. The entropy of a system depends explicitly on blurring. It depends on what I do not register, because it depends on the number of indistinguishable configurations. The same microscopic configuration may be of high entropy with regard to one blurring, and low in relation to another. This does not mean that blurring is a mental construct. It depends on actual existing physical interactions. Entropy is not an arbitrary quantity or subjective. It is a relative one, like speed. The speed of an object is not a property of the object alone. It is a property of the object in relation to another object. The speed of a child who is running on a moving train has a value relative to the train, a few steps per second, and a different value relative to the ground, 100 kilometers per hour. If his mother tells the child to keep still, she does not mean that they have to throw themselves out of the window to stop in relation to the ground. She means that the child should stop with regard to the train. Speed is a property of an object with respect to another object. It is a relative quantity. The same is true for entropy. The entropy of A with regard to B counts the number of configurations of A that the physical interactions between A and B do not distinguish. Clarifying this point, which frequently causes confusion, opens up a seductive solution to the mystery of the arrow of time. The entropy of the world does not depend only on the configuration of the world. It also depends on the way in which we are blurring the world, and this depends on what the variables of the world are that we interact with. That is to say, on the variables with which our part of the world interacts. The entropy of the world in the far past appears very low to us. But this might not reflect the exact state of the world. It might regard the subset of the world's variables with which we, as physical systems, have interacted. It is with respect to the dramatic blurring produced by our interactions with the world caused by the small set of macroscopic variables in terms of which we describe the world, that the entropy of the universe was low. This, which is a fact, opens up the possibility that it wasn't the universe that was in a very particular configuration in the past. Perhaps, instead, it is us and our interactions with the universe that are particular. We are the ones who determine a particular macroscopic description. The initial low entropy of the universe, and hence the arrow of time, may be more down to us than to the universe itself. This is the basic idea. Think of one of the grandest and most obvious phenomena. The diurnal rotation of the skies. It's the most immediate and magnificent characteristic of the universe around us. It turns. But is this turning really a characteristic of the universe? It is not. It took us thousands of years, but in the end we managed to understand the revolving of the heavens. We understood that it is we who turn, not the universe. The rotation of the heavens is a perspective effect due to our particular way of moving on Earth, rather than a mysterious property of the dynamics of the universe. Something similar might be true for time's arrow. The low initial entropy of the universe might be due to the particular way in which we, the physical system that we are part of, interact with it. We are attuned to a very particular subset of aspects of the universe, and it is this that is orientated in time. How can a particular interaction between us and the rest of the world determine a low initial entropy? It's simple. Take a pack of 12 cards, 6 red and 6 black. Arrange it so the red cards are all at the front. Shuffle the pack a little and then look for the black cards that have ended up among the red ones at the front. Before shuffling, there are none. After, some. This is a basic example of the growth of entropy. At the start of the game, the number of black cards among the red in the first half of the pack is zero. The entropy is low, because it has started in a special configuration. But now let's play a different game. First, shuffle the pack in a random way. Then look at the first 6 cards and commit them to memory. Shuffle a little, and look to see which other cards have ended up among the first 6. At the start there were none, then their number grew, as it did in the previous example, together with the entropy. But there is a crucial difference between this example and the previous one. At the beginning of this one, the cards were in a random configuration. It was you who declared them to be particular by taking note of which cards were in the front half of the pack at the beginning of the game. The same may be true for the entropy of the universe. Perhaps it was in no particular configuration. Perhaps we are the ones who belong to a particular physical system with respect to which its state can be particular. But why should there be such a physical system in relation to which the initial configuration of the universe turns out to be special? Because in the vastness of the universe, there are innumerable physical systems, and they interact with each other in ways that are even more numerous. Among these, through the endless game of probabilities and huge numbers, there will surely be some that interact with the rest of the universe, precisely with those variables that found themselves having a particular value in the past. It is hardly surprising that there are special subsets in a universe as vast as ours. It is not surprising that someone wins the lottery, someone wins it every week. It is unnatural to assume that the entire universe has been in an incredibly special configuration in the past. But there is nothing unnatural in imagining that the universe has parts that are special. If a subset of the universe is special in this sense, then for this subset, the entropy of the universe is low in the past. The second law of thermodynamics obtains. Memories exist. Traces are left. And there can be evolution, life, and thought. In other words, if in the universe there is something like this, and it seems natural to me that there could be, then we belong to that something. Here, we refers to that collection of physical variables to which we commonly have access and by means of which we describe the universe. Perhaps, therefore, the flow of time is not a characteristic of the universe. Like the rotation of the heavens, it is due to the particular perspective that we have from our corner of it. But why should we belong to one of these special systems? For the same reason that apples grow in Northern Europe, where people drink cider, and grapes grow in the South, where people drink wine, or that I was born where people happen to speak my native language, or that the sun which warms us is at the right distance from us, not too close and not too far away. In all these cases, the strange coincidence arises from confusing the causal relations. It isn't that apples grow where people drink cider. It is that people drink cider where apples grow. Put this way, there is no longer anything strange about it. Similarly, in the boundless variety of the universe, it may happen that there are physical systems that interact with the rest of the world through these particular variables that define an initial low entropy. With regard to these systems, entropy is constantly increasing. There, and not elsewhere, there are the typical phenomena associated with the flowing of time. Life is possible, together with evolution, thought, and our awareness of time passing. There the apples grow that produce our cider. Time, that sweet juice which contains all the ambrosia and all the gall of life. Indexicality. When we do science, we want to describe the world in the most objective way possible. We try to eliminate distortions and optical illusions deriving from our point of view. Science aspires to objectivity, to a shared point of view about which it is possible to be in agreement. This is admirable, but we need to be wary about what we lose by ignoring the point of view from which we do the observing. In its anxious pursuit of objectivity, science must not forget that our experience of the world comes from within. Every glance that we cast towards the world is made from a particular perspective. Taking this fact into account helps to clarify many things. It clarifies, for instance, the relation between what a geographical map tells us and what we actually see. In order to compare the map with what we see, it is necessary to add a crucial piece of information. We must identify on the map our exact location. The map does not know where we are, at least when it is not fixed in the place where it represents, like those maps in mountain villages showing routes that can be walked with a red dot next to which is written, "You are here." A strange phrase. How can a map know where we are? We might be looking at it from afar, through binoculars. Instead, it should say, "I, a map, am here," with an arrow next to the red dot. But there is also something curious about a text which refers to itself. What is it? It is what philosophers call indexicality, the characteristic of certain words which have a different meaning every time they are used, a meaning determined by where, how, when, and by whom they are being spoken. Words such as here, now, I, this, tonight, all assume a different meaning depending on who utters them and the circumstances in which they are uttered. "My name is Carlo Rovelli" is true if I say it, but untrue if someone else who is not also called Carlo Rovelli uses the same phrase. "Now it is the 12th of September, 2016, is a phrase that's true at the moment that I am writing this, but will be false just a few hours later. These indexical phrases make explicit reference to the fact that point of view exists, that a point of view is an ingredient in every description of the observable world that we make. If we give a description of the world that ignores point of view, that is solely from the outside of space, of time, of a subject, we may be able to say many things, but we lose certain crucial aspects of the world. Because the world that we have been given is the world seen from within it, not from without. Many things that we see in the world can be understood only if we take into account the role played by point of view. They remain unintelligible if we fail to do so. In every experience, we are situated within the world, within a mind, a brain, a position in space, a moment in time. Our being situated in the world is essential to understanding our experience of time. We must not, in short, confuse the temporal structures that belong to the world as seen from the outside with the aspects of the world that we observe and which depend on